Welcome to the weekly Dharma Talk podcast from the Columbus Karmatiksem Choling Buddhist Meditation Center. There are no worlds that are apart from all other worlds. Our inner world evolves in conjunction with our outer world. His Holiness the 17th Karmapa. In this week's talk, given by meditation instructor Eric Weinberg, we continue our series based on the book Interconnected, Embracing Life in Our Global Society, by His Holiness the 17th Jawang Karmapa. According to the teachings of the Buddha, goodness is natural. It does not need to be cultivated. But we do need to remove obstacles that keep it under wraps. Empathy plays a powerful role in removing obstacles and opening our goodness to life and life's goodness to us. It moves our awareness of interdependence from our heads to our hearts and moves our hearts to compassionate action. If you like our Dharma Talk series, please consider donating to Columbus Karmatiksem Choling at columbusktc.org. Enjoy the podcast.
So, well, thank you for coming today. Today, we're going to be doing chapter 5 from this book. I don't know if people have seen it. Karmapa wrote it. It's called Interconnected, Embracing Life in Our Global Society. It's really good. And it really is his reflections on how the qualities that we develop as practitioners have an important impact in the world that we're in, particularly now. Chapter 5 is from Empathy to Courageous Compassion. So I'll try to do that. I'll refer to the book a lot. There's a lot of quotable stuff. As I was preparing for this, I kept reading like phrases and sentences and paragraphs here and there to Jeannie, because she's actually involved a lot in the schools with what it is that he's talking about here. And it's so articulate. I mean, I think she'll probably be bringing this book as a reference for some of the training that she does. This has been a really, really important subject for me. As you know, from being around this stuff for long enough, there's, you know, ultimately having insight into the nature of mind is almost equivalent in a way to liberation. And yet nobody can actually tell you, because if they could tell you about it, then it's not it. It's always because there's still an illusory you that's understanding something else. And the path is really starting with calming down enough that we can have, you know, some kind of recognition that there's just basic fundamental goodness in us. He gets into this in a way. He certainly talks a lot about fundamental goodness. But through particularly this society and the social structures that are involved with differentiation between people and competition and all that kind of thing, what ends up happening is we end up losing touch with this fundamental goodness and this fundamental empathy. And when we lose touch with it, it actually can diminish. So you can see that as people get older, they can get crustier instead of softer. That was certainly true of my dad until, this is a weird thing, but in the last couple of years of his life, he had dementia. And he started to actually lose the stuff that made him crusty. Some people get angrier. He was the opposite. And he became more open and more flexible than he ever was the whole time I've known him or had known him. I remember a few years ago, probably 3 years before he died, and he was starting to have balance problems. And my brother and I were in Florida. And one night he'd gotten up in the middle of the night to go to the bathroom. My mom had taken a sleeping pill. So she slept right through the crash and the fall and found him laying on the floor in the morning when she got up, called the nursing staff and all that. And they got him up and cleaned him up and got him into bed and fixed it. No bad thing happened. He didn't, like, break anything. And Norman, my brother, said, "Dad, you have to start using a walker." And he said, "I won't use a walker, blah, blah, blah." And then there was somebody next door who had passed away, and there was an extra walker. So we brought it over and showed him how to use it and that he had to use it. And the next morning when we got there to see him, we looked at him and, "Dad, you use the walker." And he looks up and he said, "I always use the walker." "Of course I use the walker. It'd be stupid not to." It was beautiful. I have a couple stories today. This is something that Karmapa talks about, though, in terms of empathy. Sometimes it's not so easy because on the one hand, you have to lean into stuff. Empathy doesn't mean being kind of just soft and malleable. It is soft and it's open, but I wouldn't call it malleable. Empathy has to do with understanding, being open enough to really understand what's going on with somebody else. I think I'm giving the end of the talk before the beginning, maybe. Well, that happens. Anyway, this is, when I read this chapter, it occurred to me that this is a journey of understanding, giving yourself the chance to understand. And then through this practice, if you're calm enough and you're not reactive as you might otherwise be to the behavior that's in front of you, being to actually be helpful. So you receive things the way they are, and part two is you're as helpful as you can be. Because as the title says, we're all interconnected. We're all in this together. That's fundamentally what needs to happen with this life. So before I ruin the rest of my talk with my ramblings, I've been thinking about this since I read that. That's what happens to me. And just my brain rambles a little bit, and then my mouth rambles a little bit, and then you have to put up with it. So before we go further with that rambling, though, let's do the four-line refuge prayer together. Keeping in mind that reciting it three times has to do with offering refuge to everything we see, think, hear, feel, and so on. And the second time having to do with what's inside of us, what our experience is. We certainly want to offer refuge to that one inside of us that's reactive sometimes. And then the third time is literally to offer refuge to the space within us that needs to open and welcome the light of wisdom. Sanje Chudang Suki Chognam La Chang Chu Pardu Dagni Kyap Suchi Dagi Jin So Yi Pe Sunam Ki Rolap Pinchir Sanjay Drupasho Sanjay Chudang Soki Choknam La Changchu Pardu Dagni Kyapsuchi Daki Jinso Gipe Sunam Ki Rola Pinchir Sanjay Drupasho Sanjay Chudang Soki Choknam La Changchu Pardu Dagni Kyapsuchi Daki Jin So Yipe Sonam Ki Drola Penshir Sanjay Drupasho. So this nature of mind thing, the nature of mind waking up, you've probably heard me say this before. There really, for all the hundreds of millions of different forms of meditation, there are really only two categories, calming down and waking up. And you can't wake up until you calm down. So it's really important that these not just be words on a page, but that we all have some practice that's doable for us, really, and then we do it every day. It's important not to make it so exotic and so difficult that we don't get to it. Do something you can get to and do it all the time, and then let it evolve if it wants to evolve, of course. Because it will calm us down and create the causes and conditions for seeing, understanding that which is our true nature, and that is actually interconnectedness. The stages of meditation, this is not in the book, so I'll just say this quickly, because it's what I have to say is based on this, is first, recognition. It's just recognition of the goodness within us, and all the other stuff too, that's floating in and out, and getting used to the idea that these thoughts and self-concepts that we think are solid are not. They come and they go. And the second phase is what's called familiarization. That's getting used to it. So guess what? We all have a bunch of annoying stuff inside of us. I get annoyed with myself all the time. It's sort of like, though, at the first stage, you're just trying to calm down because so much reactivity has happened. The second stage is like, oh, there's that one again, because probably the same thing is annoying you now as annoyed you 20 years ago or 30 years ago or more. It's about time we recognize that they're just annoying relatives that show up now and then. And we treat them like annoying relatives with kindness, as much as possible, but we also don't put on a big party and keep them around. We let them leave as soon as they can. Suzuki Roshi used to say, when thoughts come to the front door, let them in, and then let them out the back door. Just don't serve them tea. This is very good advice. And so familiarization is that stage where you start to recognize these thought patterns and these patterns of feelings as things that actually, they're not so shocking anymore. They're just what's been around. And in some cases, we've built whole stories and narratives around them. And at that stage, you start to learn to drop the story, because the story justifying all that stuff is actually serving them tea. It's keeping them around. Yeah, don't do that. And the third phase is what's called one taste. One taste is recognizing that good thoughts and bad thoughts are thoughts. Recognizing, as Pema Chodron says, you are the sky, everything else is just weather. And these judgments about whether it's samsara or nirvana, good or bad, all of that kind of stuff, are just another part of that narrative. And when you drop it, you just kind of can observe what's going on as if the sky was observing the weather that was appearing and disappearing. The sky doesn't sit around and say, oh, that cloud's an ugly one. Or, oh, look at that cloud, it's so beautiful. Look at the way my light streams through. It's just the sky just saying, okay. That's one taste, is recognizing that all these things are of the same nature. And once you can have that kind of equanimity, that's kind of the root of equanimity, then you can realize the nature of mind, which is that this is all interdependent. And that actually the you that you think you are, your thought about yourself is way too limited. You're actually a part of everything and everything's a part of you. Conceptually, I get that. And I can talk about it. Obviously, if I'd actually realized it, I'd be a living Buddha and then I wouldn't need a book to rely on. I'd just come up here and talk and it would be a benefit. So we're not there yet. I'm not there yet. But given that that's the path, what you can see is that's also the path of how we can walk in the world, where we have to start with recognizing some space in ourselves that can accommodate things. Takes a little courage. And then recognizing that in order to understand, we've got to drop our narratives, drop our judgments, and know something about what's called empathy, which means that you don't just react to behaviors. You actually take it in and try to understand it. That doesn't mean necessarily condone it. There's a lot of bad behavior. We'll get to that. So Karmapa says, actively cultivating these qualities helps us go beyond theoretical understanding of interdependence. It's the beginning of actually experiencing enlightened mind. To begin to actually feeling ourselves as being profoundly interconnected as we increase our emotional awareness. It's interesting. A lot of people come to meditation because they're trying to get away from their emotions. He's saying, no. Increase your emotional awareness. Sometimes we speak of an inner world, and it might sound like a place separate from the world around us. He says, there's no such place. There are no worlds that are apart from all other worlds. Inner world evolves in conjunction with the outer world. That was the teaching of the Buddha, right? What you think, do, and say actually matters because of interdependence. And that's why we've been given the path we've been given, is because our minds are like all over the place and pretty crazy. And we think, do, and say stuff that, this is my judgment, but instead of evolving the world, the mandala that we're in, we kind of devolve it with our reactivity. I think you've all probably experienced it. But when you come into a situation, almost no matter what it is, and you are kind of in that space that meditation makes you aware of, that you have, and that's where you're at, almost no matter what it is that you're in the middle of, changes. The flavor of it changes. And sometimes you can even do some good for somebody when they're in the middle of something that seems like it's going to go off the rails, or it's already gone off the rails. So this inner and out, what he's saying is this inner and outer is just a conceptual thing that we do. We're an input into this vast interconnected network that we call life. And so it matters. It matters that we practice. He says that we grossly underestimate the effect of our inner world, what we perceive to be our inner world, on the outer world. The Buddha taught that in the first phrase of the Dhammapada, right? With our thoughts, we make the world. This is just, in a way, a practical repetition of that. He says that now that we can wire people up, we even wire up babies, you know, in mind study classes, courses and stuff like that at universities. It turns out, you know, some psychologists for some time were saying that empathy is nurture. It's developed through nurture. Turns out, apparently, we're actually born with it. It's part of the human stuff. And we're born with quite a bit. He said that they've wired up a bunch of babies in a bunch of natal units. And when one cries, the other ones cry. And they've found that the same part of the brain that's empathetic with someone in pain is what's firing, because they know what part of the brain that is. So babies have it. You know, how many times have you seen a cute little picture these days on Facebook or wherever, where there's some little baby trying to help some other little baby or a little animal? Or I even saw one the other day where there was a picture of a kid trying to reach up and be pulled up onto a wall by the sculpture of whoever it was, father, mother. And this little baby had toddled over there and was trying to help lift this baby up. We're all like that. And so since that's in there, one of the important things is that if it's diminished, we need to find a way to nourish it and make it healthy again. It's one of the best, most important parts of us. If we want to be enlightened beings, I mean, that's the goal that we aspire for, liberation and enlightenment for ourselves and for all beings without exception. Those aren't just words. And empathy is actually one of the main building blocks. It's not sufficient in itself, but it's absolutely necessary. Without it, no Buddha. So it's important that we actually find this in ourselves and actually work to cultivate it. He says lack of empathy reveals on an effective level what ignorance and egocentrism deny. When we engage with our empathy, we actually touch the core of our equality, equanimity, interdependence, etc., all those words. And we end up experiencing pain and joy and all those things. So it's important to understand that our life has given us circumstances. Maybe it's just karma, I don't know what it is, but we've got circumstances generally that makes us run away from pain and run after joy. And what empathy is trying to tell us is lean into it, whatever it is. Just lean into it and feel it as deeply as you possibly can so that you can understand where whatever you're experiencing is coming from, whether it's, you know, a personal thing or whether it's somebody, another person is experiencing or something the earth is experiencing. But lean into it, understand it, because he puts it really well here. Let me find it. Can't find it. So what he said is that lack of empathy is kind of a disease. We're sick with that. And it has devastating consequences. We can see that right now in the world. I mean, what's happening with the earth, what's happening politically, and he talks about politics in here. We'll get to that. What's going on really is kind of a symptom of this disease that he calls lack of empathy. What empathy does is it gives you an opportunity to see what you see and then understand what's behind it. If you don't understand what's behind it, if it's a problem, how are you going to fix it? If you don't understand what's behind it, you might grab it even if it's harmful, or you might run away from it even if you could help. Both are the opposite of what waking up is. So, he says, normally people say malaria and dysentery are major world killers, but I think apathy, which is the same as lack of empathy, kills more than any other single disease. Violence, oppression, and sheer neglect are allowed to continue because our empathy is underdeveloped or even switched off. In our interdependent age of connectivity, empathy must be a primary virtue. When we are constantly linked externally but cannot connect from the heart, we lose our basis to create a healthy global society. That's pretty heavy stuff. So he goes on a little further. He says, empathy impairment is a particularly dangerous disease for leaders. He says, I think the public should make this one of the main qualifications that they require from any politician seeking their vote. Actually, since there are scientific means to measure empathetic responses neurologically, I have a proposal. I'm half joking, of course. But imagine if, before a country holds political elections, candidates were required to undergo a neurological study to determine their level of empathy. They could be hooked up to the machines and see how they fare. I love this. If they failed the test, they could be required to undergo training until they come up to a certain mark, and only then be allowed to proceed with their election campaigns. He says, I realize this seems absurd, but imagine the impact it would have on the quality of life on this planet. I think the point's well taken. I mean, we're all at this point looking at our political leaders, obviously. I don't think it's missed any of our attention. And we will have another election next year. I've had a lot of criteria for people I voted for or voted against or whatever over the years. I suppose unconsciously I've been attracted to empathetic people, but I've never really thought of it as an objective criteria. I think I will from now on. I think this is really important. And I don't think it's a bad thing to talk about with anybody who's talking about politics. I don't see how that, the beauty of this in a sense is that that recommendation, I don't think would cause a political fight with anybody. Just that we ought to be looking for empathetic people, be they conservative or liberal or in the middle or whatever. Somebody who really understands and feels what people are feeling and recognizes that just trying to be a problem solver isn't good enough, because you won't solve any problems if you don't understand what's behind them. It's brilliant, really. So while he's kind of did that tongue-in-cheek, I'm taking it pretty seriously. He talks about how empathy can be impaired. I kind of mentioned that. In our society, the way we build it, we start out with empathy. We know that. We've measured it in babies. But we live in environments where it's a distinct disadvantage to be sensitive and caring. People harden themselves in order to just make it. And that's a problem, because empathy and compassion can be stunted and it can diminish. Doesn't mean that they can't be reinvigorated. They need good nourishment and good environment, just like anything needs good environment and nourishment. His idea is when you look at somebody and you see a behavior, what you got to remember is that you've got a backstage pass there, and use it. Go backstage. What you're seeing, what you're reacting to, is actually just the last scene in the movie. That's it. Last scene in the movie, you're reacting to it. You have no idea what the story leading up to that moment was. Since we all have this ability to calm down and maybe ask a good question or just make a caring gesture, it's possible actually to find that out, and it's worth doing it. Once again, we're just not trained to do that. We're trained to react to what we're seeing and judge it. This is good, this is bad. This is desirable, this is undesirable. This scares me, this excites me, and so on. He's saying, before reacting even, take a breath and think deeply. Where did that come from? Where did that come from? How? And can I help? Can I make this interdependent network a little brighter and a little stronger? Yeah, maybe so. Those are questions we can ask ourselves, and then maybe a question will come up that'll help somebody else. Thich Nhat Hanh has this great quote that I saw about empathy. He said, when you plant lettuce, if it doesn't grow well, you don't blame the lettuce. You look for reasons it's not doing well. It may need fertilizer or more water or less sun. You never blame the lettuce. Yet if we have problems with our friends or family, we blame the other person. But if we know how to take care of them, they will grow well, like lettuce. Blaming has no positive effect at all, nor does trying to persuade using reason and argument. That's my experience. No blame, no reasoning, no argument, just understanding. If you understand and you show that you understand, you can love and the situation will change. Karmapa talks about some challenging cases, like sociopaths. And he talks about there's a Dharma story about a guy named Angulimala. Does anybody here know that story? It was the Buddha's way of working with that. Since most people haven't heard it, I'm going to actually tell you the story because it's good. I want to preface it with, this was the favorite story of a prisoner that I worked with who was so tortured in his youth that it completely rewired his brain to the point where he really could only get pleasure in life by hurting others. After years of work, and he worked on himself because not everything about the prison system is bad. Paul Goldstein was his psychologist. And after years of work and starting just becoming mindful of the way his body felt, the way it felt when he did this or did that, and the differences, he started to become interested in how he could remake himself. So Paul called me in and we started working with meditation practices. So even in that situation, he'd been in, I think it was, this was his at least his third time. And it was a long sentence this time because it was his third time. He started to make improvement. And the prison even recognized that this is how this happens. So instead of being basically isolated, like in solitary, because he was such a scary guy, he got into the program where they take rescue animals and they retrain dogs as companion animals, and even in some cases police dogs and stuff like that. And he got this dog. And he started taking care of them. And through doing that, it kind of recharged that battery that had been dead for many, many years. He asked me at one point when he got his dog, he said, "How should I treat the dog?" I said, "Treat the dog like Buddha. This is your best teacher you'll ever have." And he was so earnest, he did. And the good news is that he's out of what they call the RTU, the residential treatment unit, where people who are psychologically very impaired have to stay. And he's in the general population now, which is good. It's a much easier life, much better life, even though it's still in prison. So that's my own Angulimala story. It's a thing, don't give up on yourself ever. And don't give up on others no matter what. Honestly, I've worked with a lot of people. He was among the most profoundly damaged. He'd been through horrific things and then became a perpetrator of horrific things. With Angulimala, was born to a wealthy family, and as a young boy was kind and well-behaved. When he was old enough, his family sent him to the home of a Brahmin to be educated. His teacher's wife took a fancy to him, and one day when the teacher was out, she made romantic overtures. Angulimala rebuffed her advances. She took this refusal very badly. And when her husband came home, she claimed the young man had attempted to seduce her. The teacher was infuriated, but concealed his wrath and determined to find a way to destroy Angulimala completely. He decided to describe to him a method that would purportedly make Angulimala semi-divine and virtually omnipotent. This method required that he kill 1,000 people within a certain period of time, chopping off their fingers and wearing them as a necklace. Anguli means finger, and mala is a mala. Yeah. The teacher was a great authority in the eyes of his students, and due to his students' trust in him, he was able to convince Angulimala that it was true. As a result, Angulimala murdered one person, then another, and thus embarked on a killing spree that left 999 people dead. And he had a big mala. That's not the way it was told, but I thought it was funny. Anyway, he had difficulty finding his last victim. Since everyone naturally fled and hid behind locked doors whenever he was known to be in the area. Although his behavior had given many people reasons to fear him, the Buddha was able to look beyond those reasons and intentionally placed himself in Angulimala's path. When they met, the Buddha, rather than trying to counter Angulimala's murderous actions by force, challenged him to stop himself. What the Buddha recognized that others could not was that Angulimala had the potential to change. This is only possible when we see that there is more to people than their actions and connect on a level beyond their external conduct. After his encounter with the Buddha, Angulimala became a monk and eventually became the source of inspiration to many people, including this prisoner I worked with. So he talks about condemning the behavior, but not the person. He talks about terrorists, talks about what he experienced when we found Osama bin Laden in his hidey hole and killed him. Karmapa said when he saw that, he was kind of in neutral. He wasn't sad, but he wasn't happy. It was like he realized this guy was a perpetrator of great harm. But what he also saw was that outside the White House that day, and you might recall that, there were a lot of people celebrating and shouting victory slogans and literally dancing. And he says, perhaps you might not mourn the death of bin Laden, but to dance and sing because a bullet managed to locate the enemy and end his life was going way too far, I felt. I had the thought that by dancing like this at the death of one enemy, in that very moment, they were giving birth to many new enemies. This is how the cycles of hatred and harm are perpetuated. The belief that our enemies are utterly unlike us is a significant problem. It's a major part of how enemies are created in the first place. And it is a part that we ourselves can change. We can condemn their behavior, but we should not dismiss the person. Killing terrorists will never end terrorism. the forces that motivate harmful behavior are dark emotions that we all have. Anger and jealousy, greed, all that stuff. And we need to understand the negative inner connections that we have to these emotions in ourselves, and the fact that others have disturbing emotions too. And sometimes it's good just to actually sit in the, as he says, in the midst of the broken glass from when we lose our temper and smash everything. Don't just run out and clean it up when you realize you made a mistake. Don't do that. Sit there and contemplate it. That relates to, believe it or not, imagine this. He's actually talking Dharma without the kind of reference points that we use. I think it might be like written down on his bones or something. You know the Lojong slogans. Slogan 49. Always meditate on whatever provokes resentment. Sit there. Look at it. Realize it's just the last chapter of the story and try to understand the story. And then make a firm choice not to rewrite that story again. So, I thought that was pretty interesting. I mean, when I'm looking at this thing, I just, it's like, really? So here's a practice recommended by Judy Leaf from Shambhala. She's a good teacher. She called it today's practice. As an object of contemplation, choose one thing that provokes your resentment and notice the cascade of sensations it triggers. You might think, well, there's plenty. Just if you can't think anything, turn on the news when you get home. It's, you'll find something. Let your reaction relax. And then bring up the same thing again. What are you clinging to? What are you afraid of losing? What insights arise when the haze of resentment is less thick? It's a good meditation. So I like that. Sit in the middle of the broken glass. Always meditate on whatever provokes resentment. This helps us when we understand ourselves, to understand others. At the very end of this, he talks about from empathy to compassion. And he says, with empathy, you have a certain sense of separateness. I empathize with you. With compassion, it's the next level. Compassion is actually the doorway to realization. It's the doorway to waking up. Because compassion is being completely one with whatever is in front of you, good, bad, or indifferent. It's that feeling that a mother has for a child when the child is suffering. It's like everything goes away except for that and for the understanding of that. He doesn't say much about it, except that it involves everything, your body, speech, and mind. And he says it much more readily translates into action. We have this kind of weird mental formation that he calls spectator compassion. It's like, oh, I wish you well. May all beings be happy. Oh. And I mean, it's all in earnest, and that may be empathetic, but that's not what the kind of compassion he's talking about. The kind of compassion he's talking about is when somebody needs something, you stop what you're doing and you give it to them. You just do. You lose yourself. You lose this individual ego for the benefit of that other, because you realize that there's a living spark of life right in front of you. Right in front of you. And it's in risk of going out. And you're there and you can keep it warm and even maybe bring it back to full flame. Bring back the life. And that's what compassion is. It's a very, very tall order. But this is me speaking. We shouldn't kid ourselves that we're all these compassionate Buddhist people. This is something we have to practice and cultivate and work on step by step, little by little. It's not like going to happen because we got a magical blessing from something in the sky and all of a sudden we can do it. And he does say that he's going to give some examples of practices we can do, but later in the third part of the book. So we'll get there. I have some practical recommendations for that, though. I looked these up. I like them. If you see someone being interrupted in a conversation, acknowledge them. Don't let them be pushed to the side. If you see someone lagging behind, walk beside them. If someone is being ignored, take the step to include them. Always remind people of their worth. It hurts when it feels like you're being forgotten. That small gesture can mean a lot. I'd give you the citation, but it says unknown. But I felt like it was good advice because, you know, truly, most of us, what was it Mother Teresa said? Most of us cannot do great things, but we can do small things with love. And I think she was the one of the best examples of that. I mean, what she did turned into a big deal, but she did it person by person. She did it by doing those things. You know, seeing somebody suffering in a gutter and getting down in the gutter with them and figuring out how to help them. So when we're talking about compassion, we shouldn't kid ourselves. That's where we're going. That's what Buddhas do. Buddhas actually invite whoever it is in and make it possible that for them to recognize their own goodness and warmth. So I think I'll stop there because there's 5 minutes or so left for questions and stuff. And please make use of the mic. Oh my gosh, I don't see anybody moving. Oh, now two people are moving. See, that was manipulative of me. I apologize.
I just, when you mentioned Mother Teresa,
yeah.
One time I was listening to an interview with Dr. Conrad Murray, who was Michael Jackson's last doctor.
Yeah.
And he took the, blame. And but he said he was like a doctor out of one of those Caribbean islands, I forget. But he said he participated in a over the phone diagnosis with Mother Teresa when she had like appendicitis or something. And because, you know, she worked with all the lepers. And
right.
So I think all her compassion affected her immune system sometimes. But that's just what I want to say. I think Grenada. That's where Dr. Conrad Murray's from.
Wow.
And I think he's kind of like a person who deserves more credit. Mm. People think he's a villain. Yeah, he's not really that bad. Of course, Michael Jackson had two doctors, and another doctor prescribed a medication that Mr. Murray didn't know about, and that's what led to the tragedy.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's sort of like when you read his name, once again, you're seeing the last scene. You don't know what the rest of the story is. Remember Paul Harvey? Stand by for news. Then there would be a break, and now for the rest of the story. I liked him just because of that.
During your talk, a couple thoughts came across my mind. One of them is I've found that I'm the happiest, and I don't mean kind of giddy or hoopla, just really very relaxed and peaceful is when I'm helping others. When I'm doing something for somebody else, I mean, it's just the downside of that is that I have a hard time being motivated to do my dishes. Or, know, if it's for me, I'm not. It's not as exciting. The other is there's this film called The Dhamma Brothers.
Yes.
About this Vipassana meditation group that arranged to have a 10-day meditation retreat in a prison, the worst prison in the United States. It's in Mississippi, for about, I don't know, maybe the dozen of the inmates who had volunteered to participate. And when it was over, they interviewed one of the guys, who's a pretty articulate fellow, and he said, you know, I never realized that I did not have to immediately react to something.
Mm-hmm.
His whole life, he'd just been immediately reacting. And then they interviewed his mom, and she said, I'd never had seen him without wrinkles across his forehead, like this really intense kind of view of how to be in the world. So just a couple stories.
Thank you. I love that film. Highly recommend it if you can find it on Netflix or whatever you can find. It's good. I bought a copy of that for a prison to show on the prison in-house TV.
Yesterday, I listened to This American Life. Did anyone hear that program?
I missed it.
It was about a treatment for post-traumatic stress disorder, and it followed the young woman who'd been molested at the age of 13, and she was the author of the piece, and it's a 10-week course. She did it in 12 days. But what it encouraged her to do was to tell her story. And then the person who functioned as a guide was her psychologist, and examine each part, each time, a sticking point in the story, a place where she told herself a story that was not helping about this incident. So it made me think of that while you were talking.
Yes.
And change her story to better reflect something she could actually not go to pieces over every time she had to speak about it.
A more realistic
approach, yeah. So it was really good.
Thank you. Well, folks, I think that's all for now. But I'll be back next Sunday. I already have a thought about how that'll follow this, because I get to do next Sunday too. So stay tuned for the rest of the story. All right, let's take a moment and dedicate merit of this time together. It's enormously beneficial to come here with good motivation to listen to the Dharma and to take it in and allow it to make openings for us, you know, so that it spreads throughout the whole world. So is a dedication just actively imagine being connected to everything by like rays of light? And take all the goodness that's within you and make all those rays just a little brighter. Causing all the things that you're connected to benefit from the warmth and the brightness that you carry with you and that became resonant from being here with these words and with this shrine and with the connection to our teachers, particularly His Holiness, the Karmapa. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for this week's Dharma Talk. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, please subscribe, rate, and review it on iTunes. To learn more about the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling or to donate to support our Dharma Talk series, please visit our website at columbusktc.org. The opening and closing music for the podcast is Tibetan Flute Song by Tamding Arts at tamdingarts.com. Please join us again next week for another Dharma Talk.